The challenge, I think, for most of us is when we have mixed questions of law and fact. Where do they fit on the sliding continuum? The test, of course, is whether the historical facts satisfy a relevant, undisputed rule of law. So in our sliding scale, if the state has really good law, they're going to want to stay far on the de novo side. This is just a question of law, ladies and gentlemen. No need to be concerned with facts. The defendant on the other side is going to want to recast the case as one involving contested factual issues resolved in the defendant's favor. So, consider these examples. If we have a confession challenge, whether the suspect was in custody. Whether the suspect was in custody is a legal question, but it's going to be determined by facts, right? Or in search and seizure challenges, Fourth Amendment challenges. Could the grandfather, in our case, give consent to search his grandson's apartment? Was the officer's belief that a crime had occurred, was that reasonable, or that an emergency existed, was that reasonable? Were there exigent circumstances? In all of these examples, we could all score 100% right now on the black letter law. We all know what the legal test is for each one of these hypotheticals, but we can't answer the question, how should the court rule? How should the court decide unless we know the underlying facts, right? So was the suspect in custody? I don't know. What are the facts? The facts are critical. The facts are critical at trial, on appeal, and absolutely for a writ practice. I think the confusion that's created by these mixed questions is because of the very bifurcated nature of a review when we have mixed questions of law and fact. We get deference to the trial court's determination of credibility, deference to the trial court's determination of historical facts, but no deference to the application of law. When we're thinking about facts, please, y'all, let's think big. Facts can include, they have to be supported by the record, of course, facts can include tangible things and actual events that occurred. They can include relationships between parties, and they can also include states of mind. That is a fact. That's a big one, and that's a fact I think as litigators on either side of the docket we often overlook. She was afraid. She was distracted by. She was certain. She was deliberate. All of those are state of mind fact determinations that can be made by a judge and may end up being critical in an individual case. The challenge is it's not always easy to distinguish between what's a question of law and what's a question of fact. So I was looking back at the Robinson case from the Court of Criminal Appeals back a decade ago in 2012. It took me a minute to do the math. It's COVID. I swear it's COVID. So the question there was the car's movement a turn or was it merely a merge? A turn or a merge? Why would we care? Well, if it's probable cause to stop for a moving violation, there has to be a moving violation. And the question was, I think, failure to use turn signal, right? The blinker. So you don't need to use a blinker on a merge. You do need to use a blinker on a turn. Was there a law violation or not? Those facts get to be important. Or the Garcia case, a little more recent from 2018. Was there really an emergency, factually, objectively, an emergency to support the existence of a blood draw in a hospital following a particularly horrific traffic accident? What facts make up the emergency? So, a challenging area with mixed questions. When we get to the area of abuse of discretion, that's an area we're likely to encounter when we're looking at evidentiary rules, motions for continuance, change of venue. So you might be thinking to yourself, there's no room for findings of fact here. It's an abuse of discretion test. And I say, au contraire, if we're using a zone of reasonableness standard, yeah, the Court of Appeals is generally not going to substitute its view for the trial judge's perception, but as advocates, our strategy can be to demonstrate that the ruling wasn't one on which reasonable minds could differ or reasonable minds would agree, right? So I'm thinking of the Perillo case back a long time ago, 1988. 1988. Oh my God. I bet many of you were not licensed. So Perea was a challenge for cause in a death penalty case, and the Court of Criminal Appeals said trial judge could have gone either way in finding this potential juror disqualified. No abuse of discretion. The case could have been resolved either yes, she's qualified, or no, she's not qualified. Either answer would have been okay. So I got to thinking about how could I have changed that as an advocate? What could I have done? Maybe I could look at the facts a little differently and talk about or get proposed fact findings or get the court to identify how she answered the questions. She went back and forth three different times. She was confused. She was hesitant in her response. Give me facts. Color in this portrait for me. Okay. Now let's move to considerations of harm. Even when there's error, what are the standards for reviewing that error? How can we effectively use fact findings or fact-based arguments? One of the easiest for us as advocates standards is, of course, a structural error standard, right? Acts or omissions that affect the whole framework under which a trial is conducted. The example that's most often used is denial of counsel. You don't have to show harm. You don't have to show prejudice. It's structural error. So there's not much for us to do as challenge as advocates. You establish the fact finding that either counsel was or was not provided. Contrast that with the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure for harmless error and the Texas standards. We've got